down the drum.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 313.EZ2116, certificate number 30932. Dagan H.
What are you doing? This is a one-way street!
We're only going one way!
You've driven overseas.
I have.
Did you get your driver's license in Korea?
No. I didn't get a license till I moved back to the U.S.,
And is that because it was not commonplace for teens to drive in Korea?
Yeah, most of my friends, I mean, a few of them who lived or drove around like the army base or the embassy housing compound, they would sometimes get licenses, but...
What about Korean kids?
Was
driving a part of teen culture there?
All the Korean kids I knew mostly had nice business or expat packages, so they all had drivers.
Yeah, oh, really?
Straight up. Like we were like the only family without a driver. We were kind of on the wrong side of the tracks.
There's that guy in the Gangnam Style video that's like drifting in that parking garage. He has a driver's license.
Yeah, he's the only one. I mean, Korea it's a little different now, but Korea was a pretty rough place to try to learn to drive in the 80s. I mean, it was kind of anarchy out there.
And you've driven, what overseas territories or countries have you driven in?
Not that many.
When you go to the UK, do you get a car?
Yes, we've rented cars, UK, continental Europe, so like France, Germany, Netherlands.
Total anarchy in
Scandinavia.
In Germany.
Well, I mean, with a lot of these places, you're dealing with little country roads once you get off the main Autobahn or A or M highway or whatever it is.
Amazing to think that two cars could ever get through some of those little villages.
It's hard. I don't know what they do. Maybe it's just never come up. Maybe two cars have never approached each other on some of these. But they either have hedgerows just coming right at you or these flinty walls.
Flinty walls.
That you're afraid might just like...
That was my nickname in college.
Flinty walls. It's a Bond girl name.
Flinty walls. Oh, yeah. That would be a great Bond girl.
Often I end up not driving as much, especially in left-hand drive countries, because Mindy prefers, maybe she prefers that I not drive, but what she says is she prefers that I navigate.
Oh, and she does the driving.
She would rather not have to be in charge of knowing, because I think she gets stressed out, especially if I'm like, which way at this roundabout? And if she doesn't know, then she's like,
she's on the spot.
Suddenly she's, the $64,000 question.
So she's the pilot and you're the navigator.
Yes. She would rather have me be the point of failure. I mean, I guess the driver can also just ram into a wall or a Hilux or something if that's what you're into.
Have you ever driven in a country where the traffic laws were more fluid, where, as you're saying in Korea, but it's true in a lot of countries in the world where the lines on the road are merely suggestions. People are going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah. The thing I remember about Korea in the 80s is lanes were just, people would often just drive right down the lane divider because that way they'd have...
Sure, a choice.
You can go left or you can go right. If I commit to a lane, then a whole universe is blocked off to me.
Yeah, here in the U.S. we say pick a lane, but really, we don't even know the half of it.
I remember, I don't know, where have we driven lately that was a little dicey? Like in Costa Rica, the roads aren't great, but I don't remember the traffic being... kind of
scary in any way.
Yeah. I mean, I've driven in Athens.
Oh, you have?
Where?
Okay. That
there are five lanes of traffic and maybe 15 different car, you know, 15 different lanes. If you believed what the cars were doing,
just crossing a street in Athens made me kind of feel like I was on The Amazing Race or something.
Yeah. So. It was really incredible. And I, you know, drove all over Greece. So had the whole variety of experiences there, but yeah, I've driven in Africa. I've driven in places where, I've never driven in India though, which seems like the ultimate kind of,
that's the boss level,
heroic level of learning to drive.
Or maybe some kind of East Asian capital. I mean, is Hanoi any better? I don't know.
I feel like it's kind of the x-axis is like the freewheelingness of it, and the y-axis is number of people trying to get from A to B.
Yeah.
So,
and you got bikes in the mix in a lot of these places. Scooters. That's kind of a wild card.
But I don't know if this is, I don't know if this is commonly known. It certainly was. It's kind of hard for me to get my head around. But you know, a third of the people on Earth drive on the left-hand side of the road.
It's got to be almost entirely India.
It
right?
is mostly India, although you know, all of southern Africa or southeastern Africa, the former British colonies, mm-hmm. Drive on the right, the left-hand side of the road. Pakistan also a large, you know, contributes a lot of just sheer volume to that figure.
The only major non-British colony that has left-hand drive still is Japan.
Well, not a colony.
Sorry. Yeah, that's what I said. The only non-British colony.
Oh, I see. Non-British colony.
The only country.
Not non-British colony.
Colony.
Right.
Yes. The only country that still has left-hand driving, not as a result of the Commonwealth, I think is Japan.
Thailand also drives on the left and right. Also was never colonized.
The one time I was in Thailand, we actually ended up driving across the border into Cambodia to see Angkor. And I thought it would be fun to go by land instead of taking the quick 45-minute flight.
Of course, you're a fun guy.
Well, one of the reasons why is because I wanted to see what it looks like at a land border where a left-hand drive nation meets a right-hand drive one. Like, is it just a stream of hilarious accidents all day? Or is there some kind of Mobius strip of a bridge tunnel thing?
And what did you find?
It was incredibly disappointing. I think maybe between like Macau and Hong Kong and the mainland, there are maybe better examples of weird engineering to get around this.
Yes.
But at this particular Thai-Cambodian border point, it was there was so little land traffic that basically a car would pull up to the border, they'd get their papers checked, and then they would drive through and just kind of switch sides. And then, you know, then a truck would come the other way and it would switch sides too. You know, you could just kind of maneuver around whoever was switching.
Well, there are Thailand is one of the rare instances where left-hand drive and right-hand drive interact on the
land border.
Because if you think about it, the UK is an island, Japan is an island, Australia, New Zealand are both islands. And, you know, Southeastern Africa is an island entire of itself.
Yeah, there's not a lot of highways connecting those countries with the right-hand drive ones.
But Thailand has overland borders with Laos, Cambodia, and Malaysia, all of which drive on the other side of the road. And there are ones that you describe where it's a small border and there's a stoplight and you go through the stoplight and you're on the other side of the road.
Each green is one truck going through and that's how they do it.
But there actually are kind of highway interchanges that do this big it's a Mobius strip where it's like, okay, you're on this side and then a big overleaf thing and a bridge and now you're on the other side and good luck. God bless.
But all your atoms have been reversed.
Yeah, that's right.
You're left-handed now. The polarity of light is different in each retina.
And they also border Myanmar that drives on the left because it's a former British colony.
Ooh, former Burma. Interesting.
But there are reasons why Japan and Thailand drive on the left, not on the right. But you're right that the British Empire is predominantly the reason that a third of the people in the world still drive on the left.
It's their little gift. We made fun of cricket, but there's an even better one.
That's right.
Weird cars.
Thank you. Thank you, United Kingdom. But it's kind of a strange state of affairs, given that really cars are still only about 120 odd years old, that this
mine is
that this kind of late stage development should be so divisive globally. Like we already were living in the modern age. How is it that we failed to make this, you know, I mean, it's sort of like 110, 220 electricity.
It's exactly what it's like.
Why? Or metric system and imperial system.
Just trying to plug in your phone charger in any other country, you realize, oh, there's six different styles of plugs. We never figured this out in time to, right, you know, turn the train around.
And it's strange to think that the technology, that during a period of like very quick technological advances, cars, electricity, airplanes, and trains that all kind of came online within about 100 years of one another. We were living in a modern era, but not yet one that had standardization as a global practice.
I guess because there was overlap, right? We're probably going to see this again with self-driving cars. You know, there were still horse-drawn carriages on the road when the first traffic laws were being written. And so everything got codified with that in mind. And then when they went away, you were stuck with weird artifacts. Like, yeah, the whole thing about left and right-hand drive has origins in how carriages would drive, right?
Well, a lot older than that, actually. Traveling on the left was an ancient practice. The Roman legions marched on the left.
In the carpool lane?
They passed on the left, right. And it was actually for a long time a symbol of status. Like if you were poor, you traveled on the right relative to the people traveling on the left. You passed on the left, basically. But also traveled, I guess if you were poor, you moved right to left to let
the idea is that
superior
the,
travelers.
Because they're going faster than you probably. They've got better tech and places to be, and you're just a dope.
Well, what it
just dumb Kevin in a mule cart has to stay
has
right?
Has to stay right, but... But the reason that traffic moved on the left had everything to do with what side of your body you wore your sword. If you're a right-handed swords person, you wear your scabbard and your sword on the left-hand side of your body.
Right.
And if you are traveling down a narrow path and a swordsman comes the other direction and you both have your swords on the left-hand side, your swords are going to bang into one another. And so,
oh, this is not supposing any kind of encounter. You're not ready for danger. It's just bumping scabbards with a dude, which is kind of, did they think that was gay?
It's a little bit, it has overtones, but no, it actually has to do with an encounter. If you are walking on the right-hand side and you draw your sword and he draws his sword, presuming that you're both male swords peoples, you're now offside, right? Your sword is in your right hand side. His sword is in his right hand side, and now you have to pivot. You have to swing your sword all the way across your body and across the road.
You might cut off your own nose.
Yeah. Whereas
or a Vespa might come between you.
If you're on the left hand side and you draw your sword, you are right there. You know, ready to fence.
But really, what are the odds that a random couple of passersby meeting in the street? How often would that turn into a duel? Do you think it was maybe like 2 out of 3 times back in the day?
I think so. I mean, there was
you can't get even down to the drugstore because you got to duel 8 guys.
We have a lot of brigand privilege here in our current life. I mean, when was the last time you fought a brigand?
Yeah, I don't think about brigands. Yeah. And it's true. I don't have
Highwaymen. But at the time, any person you encountered on the road might suddenly draw upon you because, I mean,
does happen to me sometimes, but then I just roll a 10-sided die
to
see how I did.
Right. I'm also deriving that knowledge almost entirely from Dungeons and Dragons. But that was the standard, you know, you have to have a convention more or less, Athens notwithstanding. And for most of history, people traveled on the left-hand side of the road. And this was true in Japan too. It was part of the samurai code that you traveled on the left because the samurai also were wearing their swords in scabbards on the left-hand side of their body.
It seems like it should be a minor part of the code. Don't you agree that right, it should have more things about nobility of spirit? There should be a lot of things like that. And then maybe at the bottom, it's like also walk on the left.
Well, it, you know, the devil's in the details. You can spend a lot of time thinking about, oh, the nobility or whatnot. But if your swords are banging into other guys' swords, how do you keep your dignity?
Where's your tranquility of spirit?
Right. It starts with the letter of the law, and then from whence proceeds the spirit of the law.
Are you saying that's probably the number one samurai rule? Like, the first day of samurai school, they're like, walk over there. Nope.
Wrong.
Tanaka, you're doing it wrong.
stare at the wall. I think it was sort of globally the convention until the 18th century. There was no reason. Again, it's just a matter of habit and convenience. It wasn't really codified into law. There wasn't that much traffic on the road, right? And I think even in
that's the Cambodian border issue.
Yeah. If you look at pictures, I mean, early 19th century photographs of cityscapes, you kind of get the feeling that the cars are all just driving, and cars and horses are all kind of mingling on the streets of New York. Kind of, there isn't a clear one side is traffic is moving in one direction and the other.
I'm lucky enough to have this random picture of 1928 St. Louis in front of me.
And what does it look like?
There's no direction here.
Not really.
There's just a few scattered wagons and a truck.
And in the 18th century, it was sort of the first time that there was enough real traffic, this was the dawn of moving freight in larger quantities from place to place. You know, right. We were developing a kind of manufacturing capitalist mentality in the West, certainly.
There were always wagons full of hay where you could hide outlaws, right, or rum or gold.
That's right.
But that's just a way to get in the castle gates.
Yeah, and you're not encountering a lot of wagons also carrying bandits or gold or rum coming the other direction that you would be so confused that you would need like hard and fast rules.
Do you think any of them were legitimately just hay wagons, or do you think all of those were just smuggling stuff?
I've ridden in a lot of hay wagons, and they all have some kind of contraband.
I knew it. Yeah. I knew it.
Yeah. But it was in the sort of later 18th century that there started to need to be rules because of just the increasing traffic. And what was kind of developing during that time was the new technology that we covered in our Conestoga wagon article. Do we call these articles?
Yeah, episodes. Yeah, articles. We have a Substack called Omnibus. And we entries, I think we usually say.
Entries, that's it. The idea of larger wagons that were being pulled not by one or two horses, but by a team of horses, necessitated kind of a new way for a driver to control a team.
You're wider.
You're wider, but you also have a lot more horses to deal with. And in those early iterations of very large wagons that were carrying a ton of freight, the wagons themselves didn't have a driver's seat. And the way that the teamster controlled the team was that they actually sat on the rearmost left-hand horse. And again, it was because the majority of them were right-handed. And so in order to control a team of six or more horses, if they sat on the rear left horse and had their whip in their right hand, they could, you know, selectively, and this is from a time when people had an Indiana Jones level of dexterity with a whip.
Everybody in America could just whip a cigarette out of somebody's mouth in a vaudeville show. Whoopsh.
So you've got six horses and you're trying to turn them around a curved bridge. And with with your right hand, you could control a large team by being able to kind of snap your whip at any one of those individual horses. And if you were sitting on the right-hand side, you'd be whipping across your body. And so the convention became that these large teams would drive on the right-hand side. Because when you're passing another team, you want to have if you're sitting on the back left horse, you want to have a view up the side of the team to make sure your wheels don't clam into a wagon coming the other way.
You want to be closer to the opposing traffic.
That's right. And so during this period, the first few, the first few countries started to, you know, kind of in the mid to late 18th century, there started to appear, like in 1752, Russia was pretty early in passing a law that traffic kept to the right. In America, it happened a little bit later, but America was one of the places where these big teams started to be a function, or, you know, to create the need for there to be traffic laws. In Britain, these large teams, these sort of cross-country Teamster wagons, weren't in common use. It was
why? You know, why do you think?
There just wasn't need to move enormous goods and services that they couldn't better use boats.
Oh, right.
So teams of horses were still kind of smaller wagons with fewer horses that were moving goods from barges to inside the city, but they didn't have this sort of economy of wagon train that played such a large role in the United States.
So that's the difference between left and right hand side countries, turns out to be who was using barges versus who was using big wagons.
Well, not necessarily. What happened then was that those kinds of large wagons became very popular in France. And this was just prior to the Napoleonic era. And Napoleon, when he came to power and
annoyed your mom
and annoyed my mom and everyone else in Europe, Napoleon's armies marched to the right.
I thought they marched on their stomach.
Napoleon's army marched on your stomach.
They marched on the right side of their stomach.
As they invaded Europe, they hewed right. And because they'd picked up that habit from this sort of the large team technology, which
even though in every earlier era soldiers would have walked on the left, this was the first army to march on the right.
Yeah, and this is also in some ways a sign of modernity, because we're no longer carrying swords. We're a new mechanized army, and this is the way we, one of many ways that we express that it's a new era. And in fact, in the United States, that transition driving your teams on the right actually had a kind of nationalist side to it, because when we left the British Empire, this was again a sign that an indication of the American way. We had bigger wagons and more ground to cover.
It's the same reason we don't use metric today.
Right.
Because everyone else does, and screw them.
But when Napoleon set out across Europe and conquered all of all the countries that he conquered, he brought right-hand driving with him and set into action a kind of European turmoil where, after Napoleon was, you know, defeated and sent to his island exile a couple of different times, the countries that the Napoleonic armies had conquered retained right-hand driving, and the empires where he'd made no inroads retained left-hand driving. So post-Napoleon, Austria, Hungary, Czech Republic continued to drive on the left, whereas France, Germany, the Low Countries now were right-hand drivers. Russia had established right-hand driving in the mid-18th century, and so Finland was a right-hand driver. Denmark drove on the right. Sweden remained a left-hand driver. Spain, although, you know, a vassal state of Napoleon, Spain very curiously, and we'll get to this in a minute, but maintained a kind of half and half, go your own way.
Half and half. Not going to work.
And in Austria, you know, Napoleon invaded Austria up to a point, but never completely conquered the nation.
Okay.
And within the nation of Austria, until World War II, half of the country drove on the left and half of the country drove on the right. And it perfectly coincided with where the furthest advance of the Napoleonic armies.
But the border towns must hate that, just like the places in Indiana where it's half daylight savings time or used to be.
Well, again, most of those places had villages with flinty walls and really only room for one lane of traffic at any given point. And there are plenty of places in Europe where who knows what side of the road you're driving on, even now.
Yeah, you're driving in the middle.
You're driving wherever you can drive.
Until some opal comes the other way.
Yeah, it's only on the Autobahn or in places where the highways are 20th century highways that or roads through cities that it's even really clear to this day.
This terrifies my some of my siblings and in-laws when they come up to Seattle. We often have, you know, little tiny roads that are kind of de facto one way, a lot of neighborhood roads here. And, you know, people just kind of figure it out. Somebody blinks in the game of chicken and moves into the last available parking spot or hydrant or whatever it is. And somebody comes the other way.
It horrifies them. Oh, because they're from Salt Lake where the roads are super big?
Sure. Well, they're from some smaller town where every road is, yeah, or Utah where every road is a, Brigham Young said every road had to be 12 lanes for some reason.
Well, so you could turn your horse cart around in the city,
gotta
right?
Got to be able to turn your wagon around.
Isn't that what it is?
That's
the legend.
That's definitely the legend. I have no idea if that's actually true, but the roads are very wide, so.
Well, so enter the 20th century and it's surprisingly a jumble globally. There are an awful lot of countries that are still either de facto or by law driving on the left-hand side and lots of other countries on the right. And in Europe, it's a patchwork. Africa is absolutely a patchwork. There are as many rules as there are continents. And in Japan, and this is happening completely kind of, I mean, we're moving from the Edo period with this habit, this left-hand side
samurai era
policy. But it was in the mid 19th century, after Japan opened to the West, that she decided that rail was going to be the big game there. I just gendered Japan because it's just how we do. Because I'm a boomer.
I usually say they.
They.
Because, not because they've expressed a preference, but just because there's so many of them.
Right, there's a lot, and they're not all women. But Japan decided to build a rail network in the late 1800s, mid-late 1870s. And it may not surprise you that the Western powers all took a big interest in being the helpmeets. The
supplier?
Yeah, of rail technology. And the United States and France and Britain all kind of made proposals, and Britain won the bid. And so it was the UK that helped the Japanese build their initial trains and absolutely put those trains on the left-hand side. And
does this mean that all countries, the rail systems tend to mirror the direction of automobile traffic?
The rail systems do, and there are plenty of examples where the rail system was built to travel on the left-hand side in conjunction with traffic that used to travel on the left, and then traffic moved to the right, but the rail didn't.
Yeah.
So you'll see countries like Portugal where the rail is one way and the cars are the other.
Because it's easier to remove cars.
Right.
You just have to change signage, but there's more infrastructure on track.
Well, in fact, you could just switch it on track, but who knows? Who knows why? You could just make the trains go the other direction.
Because trains are run by crotchety, old-timey men with little glasses perched on the bridge of their nose.
It is true about infrastructure that it isn't just signage, right? I mean, a train station is on one side,
yeah.
and all the hoppers and all the, I mean, everything is oriented. And one of the big expenses, one of the main expenses of switching sides is transit. You know, buses only open on one side, right? It's a trams open on one side typically.
I think they should just leave the buses until they run out the natural end of their lives and people just have to dismount in traffic and hope for the best.
Right. I love the idea of buses stopping and you have to get out in the middle of the street
little game of Frogger.
The bus leaves.
You don't cross the street there. You kind of edge around the bus carefully.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
and in Amsterdam, you do see trams that drop their passengers off on an island in the middle of the road. But yeah, it's you kind of don't think about it, but in the country where you live, the trains are mirroring the roads or vice versa.
Hmm.
And so when when cars entered into Japan, the system was already established, left-hand drive, and it never, because it was an island, it didn't have to interact with other countries, and it retained, just like the UK, retained its left-hand drive against all other odds. European countries and North American countries kind of ad hoc'd their way into which side of the road they drive on now. In 1924, Canada had a kind of interesting situation because Quebec drove on the right.
No.
Yeah. And
they're borrowing their Francophone Napoleonic tradition.
They absolutely were. And the rest of Canada was following the sort of British tradition.
It was British Canada, yeah.
It was BC, I think, that BC was one of the early provinces to switch over because they had a
lot
more.
You mean the comic strip BC? When they were on those little wheels?
Yeah.
They would go on the right?
Yeah, birds got hairy feathers in BC. Apteryxes. But they switched over. They had a lot more sort of, and the Atlantic provinces, I guess. I mean, it was a gradual switch. And in the 20s in Canada, like if you were driving from Winnipeg to Edmonton and it changed over, like how would you even know? How would you notice?
You're just driving whiskey into the U.S., right? Yeah. That's probably 80% of all road traffic.
Right. Portugal in 1928, Poland and Spain, I guess, switched in 24. But again,
this is all left to right, right?
This is all going from left to right. Although in Spain, in Barcelona, they already drove on the right. In Madrid, they drove on the left. So until the 1930s, or at least until Franco settled this
definitively anti-Barcelona.
And this is
if the other side had won the Civil War, Spain would drive on the left, maybe.
No. Barcelona drove on the right. So he actually conformed to, I guess, what would have been the European standard.
I guess the Catalonians won the culture war, at least.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. They won the driver war. They won the you know what? Barcelona in the streets, Madrid in the sheets. Let's see. And then we get to World War II. And a lot of the countries that were Japanese colonies, like Korea, were driving on the left as a part of their the colonial imperative.
Yeah, they probably didn't have too much wagon traffic predating their new colonial occupiers.
But Hitler, and this is not to discredit driving on the right, but Hitler was a real drive-on-the-right kind of guy. And so when Austria unschlussed into Germany, on that day, with very little forewarning or any kind of infrastructural change, by decree, all of Germany switched over to, or all of the sort of German greater co-prosperity sphere, all switched over to right-hand drive in a single
night. They switched Austria the same day they invaded or annexed.
But the Czech Republic also was still driving on the left.
So the Von Trapps get home from their honeymoon and suddenly all the signs are different?
It's like, well, the signs aren't even different. You're just driving on the other side of the road. And there were a lot of accidents precisely because they hadn't switched over the signage or changed any of the, what little infrastructural signage there was in these more rural parts of Austria. But I mean, it's not like the Czech Republic was rural entirely.
Right.
Big cities there. So it all switched over. Hungary didn't actually switch until the German invasion in 44. And these were all countries that were left over. They were ones that Napoleon hadn't reached, and they retained left-hand driving as a middle finger to Napoleon that whole time.
It's funny to imagine these waves of right-hand driving just coming as military invasions, like, a tide of Napoleon And then it recedes, leaving wet beach.
Yeah.
And then a tide of Hitler goes further. Oh, and then wet beach.
A little bit more pushback. But World War II, at least in Europe, really standardized right-hand driving. And I think all you have to do is be driving down the wrong side of the road and a column of panzers is coming at you to realize, I guess that's going to convince you maybe to start driving on the right get rolled over.
So if you're dedicated Antifa today, you should be driving on the left in defiance of Hitler's preference.
Right, except
you'll get hit by a truck.
Well, you're just mirroring the colonial empire of the British, which which side?
Both sides are now tainted.
That's right. If you're Antifa, I think you
sell your car and you buy
you're on a hoverboard.
Yeah,
right.
A hoverboard, really? I was going to say like electric bike or solar wheel or something.
Well, but you know, bikes have to conform to these rules of the road too.
In theory.
So at the end of the war, there had been quite a few countries that switched, countries in Europe that switched to right-hand driving. But in Asia, when America invaded Okinawa, America instituted right-hand driving in Okinawa as part of its
power move,
and in Korea also. So Koreans were driving on the left until the end of World War II.
But then, when the MacArthur's occupation began on mainland Japan, why didn't they do the same?
I feel like it was just infrastructurally incredibly difficult and largely unnecessary.
Yeah,
right?
I guess the war's over at that point.
In Okinawa, the U.S. military controls something like 30% of the land area. And in taking over Okinawa, and we see it today, like the principle of the American military occupation of Okinawa was, this is now an American territory. Or, I mean, that was the kind of mentality that they had. Whereas Japan, they always were sensitive to the idea of that. And I feel like that's introducing right-hand drive in Korea was possible because of the anti-Japanese sentiment was so strong that you could introduce it as a kind of reversal of Japanese colonialism.
You're saying there was less anti-Japanese sentiment in Japan.
In Okinawa, right, which considers itself part of Japan, even though the indigenous people there, like Mr. Miyagi, are, you know, like agitate for their own
identity. They see
identity.
Both sides. He's like those guys in Hawaii that fly the Hawaiian flag upside down or whatever.
and it turns out that the side that you drive on as an expression of your new status at the end of colonialism, it was a way of expressing your anti-imperialism. As late as the 1970s, Nigeria and Ghana both switched over to right-hand driving as a
FU to the British.
As much as an FU to the British as to...
I mean, they probably also had French colonized neighbors so that it would ease regional traffic issues with, right?
Well, yeah. And if you look at
Niger borders, Niger, and a bunch of other countries that would have had right-hand drive.
Yeah, you can see in the way that Africa, even now, you know, is there's this British Empire kind of the roads line that still is on the other side. But yeah, that's the roads.
I mean, where they were going, they didn't need roads, but he was there anyway.
But those Central African countries, yeah, they would have been completely enveloped in right-hand driving nations, and so it is a way of kind of expressing independence, or was for a long time, and Pakistan actually considered after the partition, considered switching over to right-hand driving, but in evaluating the conditions on the roads, it was they realized that there were a lot of people driving teams, camel teams even, where it was the convention to get the team going and then the driver would fall asleep and the teams would just you know, kind of go through the night.
So you can't change the, you can't just change the signs. You've got to retrain hundreds and thousands of livestock.
That's right. And so that alone kind of became a determining factor on whether or not, you know, it was like, is this worth doing? I mean, this is going to cost a lot of money anyway, but we're going to have all these livestock collisions.
Confused oxen.
Right. So, so they elected, not to make the switch. But our story today concerns...
Oh, what's the timestamp here?
Concerns one of the last European, you know, continental European countries to make the switch, and that is Sweden. And Sweden was surrounded by right-hand drive countries. Finland...
Is that right? Norway and Finland were already...
Norway, Denmark, all right-hand drive. Finland because of its connection to
Russia.
Russia. And, you know, Denmark and Norway made made right-hand driving the law very early. I think Denmark was in the 1790s, mandated it right-hand drive. And Sweden was an outlier. And it was kind of a source of, well, it was weird how it played in Sweden because it was a source of kind of national individuality. Although the Swedes throughout the 20th century, you know, they love American cars. I don't know if you know this about Sweden. There are a lot of Harley Davidson clubs there. And if you follow the vintage car market, like the hot rod car market, a lot of American hot rods, vintage, you know, Camaros and whatnot, are purchased by Swedes.
They're having their kind of gloomy Bergman-esque musings.
Yeah.
From a Mustang.
They love Mustangs up there. And so into the 50s and 60s, the Swedes, although Britain was right there and could have been importing Rovers, they wanted American cars. And
which all had steering wheels on the left.
Yeah. And by the mid 60s, 90% of the cars on the road in Sweden were left-hand drive, you know, made by the United States for right-hand driving.
And do you get the sense that, like really how different is the driving experience to be driving a kind of car where you're further from the center line? I mean, do you find it all that? I find it hard to adjust, first of all, to where my center line is when I have to do that.
I do too.
But I don't know if it's inherently that much worse, more dangerous.
Well, what happens is if you're driving a left-hand drive car on the right-hand side of the road, which we do here in the United States, you're looking at oncoming traffic where you and the opposite driver are both sitting on the closest side of the car to one another. So you can pass another car fairly close by.
You can do a little steering wheel wave with your hand.
You go, hey, what's up? Beep, beep. Whereas if you're driving, say, a German car in the United Kingdom where you're on the opposite side from the other drivers, I mean, I found...
It only moves you like 3 feet.
It does, but I found it driving in the UK... In a left-hand drive car.
Oh, which you have done?
I've done many times.
Why? Because took a ferry from Calais?
Yeah, when we would begin our tour, our booking agent was located in Hasselt, Belgium. And so we would fly into Antwerp or whatever. We would drive out to Hasselt. He would have rented us a Sprinter van, and we would go to a rental agency and get our amplifiers or whatnot. And we'd tour around the Low Countries. And then we would go to Dover and take the ferry over. And it made no sense to go to the UK and rent all that stuff again.
Yeah.
Because it was an overland tour. And so we would often spend a couple of weeks driving around the UK in a Belgian van. And we had to have transformers for all our electrical stuff because right. We had American, some of our stuff was American, our pedal boards or whatnot. But so I'm driving a big van, which is already complicated. And I'm on the wrong side of the car. And I can't tell you the number of rearview mirrors I knocked off of parked cars driving through the UK. I should be in jail.
You're
right
still
now.
Famous.
That's right. It's the I was known throughout the continent as the rearview mirror bandit. Because I just couldn't ever quite get myself. I mean, by the end of the tour, I was pretty good at it. But you just don't know where the center line is.
Yeah.
And because you're looking across, I mean, one of the craziest things for me in driving in the UK is realizing that to look at my rearview mirror, I have to look up and to the left. And I'm so used to looking up to the right that I would look up and out the window.
Nope, nobody's coming.
Looking for my rearview mirror and like, oh, it's over here. And so it was the opposite effect of that.
Yeah.
Where my rearview mirror was in the right place, but what was I looking at? I wasn't looking at the lane. I wasn't looking at traffic the way I was used to. And that, you know, there are a lot of people in the UK that drive American cars. And here in the United States, if you want a fancy wedding, you know, you're in a white Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
Or if you're, you know, you're a hipster and you're driving like a Japanese domestic market
weird GTR minivan or something. Yeah.
Yeah. But there are a lot of issues as more and more cars enter the world. And this was the thing that was happening in Sweden. In the 40s and 50s, the population of Sweden and the number of cars on the road, Sweden was still kind of a rural backwater, really, and then experienced this boom in population after the war and a real boom in the number of drivers on the road. And by some statistics, like there were three times more cars in 1965 than there had been in 1955. And so all these traffic problems, and in particular, given that most of the Swedish cars were driving on the wrong side, because this is the crazy thing. Volvo elected to build left-hand drive cars.
Only? Just because they knew they were mostly an export market?
Yeah, they were trying to export them and
so they didn't do both.
They didn't do both.
Huh.
And Swedes weren't really fascinated with British cars. And I think, you know, the quality of British cars in the early 60s will bear this out.
So the bulk of the cars on the road were designed for right-hand side driving, even though they didn't have it.
So it became an issue in Sweden pretty early on in the 20th century. They were constantly debating in the parliament, like that we should get in sync with the rest of Europe, we should get in sync with the rest of the world. But that individuality and that kind of the kind of rural preference, but also just the stubbornness that any nation has.
It's always easier to not reform something. That's why we still have pennies.
They would have a referendum and the citizens would vote down any change. And they kept doing that even as infrastructure was expanding. I mean, if they had made this change in 1919, it would have been a lot easier.
There's six signs.
But as late as 1958 or 9, they had a big popular vote on it, and 83% of Swedes voted against making any change. But this was a time, you may or may not recall, the late 50s, early 60s, when there was still a lot of conformity and a lot of there was a lot of deference to men in power.
Yeah, I've seen the movies.
Yes, this is how it was. People wore suits and there were people in charge.
If a guy had a fedora, you had to do what he said. Whereas today, if a guy has a fedora, you just need to...
You just roll a 10-sided die and get him out of there. we saw this in Seattle as late as the 1990s when we as a population voted in favor of a monorail in the city three separate times. And yet the governing bodies... The city council in particular, but the legislature too, somehow found a way not to build it.
If you like, why even vote for monorail three times? Just vote for a single tri-rail.
Oh, interesting.
And you save so much trouble.
I don't think anybody really proposed that. That's a great idea. We also voted twice against building a brand new stadium downtown.
And that happened anyway.
So even as late as the 1990s, and maybe even still today,
your vote doesn't count.
Your vote doesn't count. But in the 50s in Sweden, in the late 50s, in spite of 83% of the people not wanting to switch, really preferring to be the last nation on continental Europe, with the exception of, I think it's still left-hand drive in Gibraltar, Malta, and...
Yeah, Malta is for sure. Yeah. I guess Gibraltar is, but that doesn't count.
Not really. I mean, Sweden was the real last holdout. In spite of the vote, the government said, actually, we're going to do this anyway. The vote was kind of just a little bit of a gag.
If only we had thought of that with Brexit.
But the Swedes, being who they were, said, you know what? We're going to roll this out after a very, very long propaganda campaign. We're going to educate everyone over the course of years. They did not follow the Hitler model. They decided in the early 60s that they were going to make the switch and began a four-year period of educating the people of Sweden about this, what would end up being a big change in a single weekend.
Yeah, you can't do this incrementally.
No.
It's better to rip the Band-Aid off.
And it became a whole kind of branding campaign. There was this beautiful logo, which was the letter H with an arrow kind of crisscrossing the letter H, starting on the left-hand side and crisscrossing over and going up the right-hand side.
I hope that's not how they did it. What does the H stand for?
Well, the Swedish word for right is Huger.
Okay.
And so this whole campaign was called Huger Traffic, which just means right traffic. Mm-hmm. And so there were brochures printed, but the Huger Traffic logo ended up becoming kind of a fashion statement. Like, women's underwear had the Hugo logo on it. I don't even know if they said Hugo logo, but Huger logo.
Luger.
It was like popular on t-shirts. I mean, it was a branding campaign.
I mean, they're public-minded, the Swedes.
They are.
They like to get behind a nice communitarian initiative, even if they voted against it. Multiple times.
There was a campaign to come up with a theme song, and the winner of the theme song was written by a reporter, but it became a hit, kind of a surprise hit. It got up to number 5 on the charts.
And that song was Young Folks by Peter, Bjorn, and John.
No, that song's been canceled, I'm afraid. No, it was, the song was called Keep to the Right, Svensson.
Classic.
Kind of a hit. And what's interesting is that in Swedish slang, keeping to the right also means be faithful to your wife.
So that's also good advice for Svensson.
That's right.
Assuming he's straight and married.
So the Swedes love a double entendre. And then this had that triple element of like,
this is the opposite of a double entendre because it's not dirty. It's it makes an extremely clean joke.
It does make a clean joke.
Be faithful to your wife.
You don't want to go left.
Naughty.
Don't go left. That way leads to ruin. So after a very long public education campaign, on the weekend of September 3rd, 1967. Now this is 1 year before I was born. So I was born into a world where the Swedes had already made this transition.
And you can probably sense that about yourself. Yeah. It just seems wrong, the idea of a Svensson passing somebody on the...
Yeah, think about Svensson keeping to the left. It offends the senses.
And yet, I find it very titillating.
Right?
Svensson shouldn't be doing that.
But it went off without a hitch. And at the time, the event was like a global news story. And the sense is that... newspaper reporters all flooded into Stockholm because they were waiting for the carnage.
Something crazy to happen.
Yeah, they're all standing in the street with their notepads out and a little card in their fedoras waiting for it to be awful.
They want a Godard movie.
And they did, in a lot of Sweden, they made the transition over the course of about 24 hours.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. If it's a collision in time rather than space, it's a whole different set of issues. Does everybody just go home? Is there a time when nobody's supposed to be on the road? Or at a certain time, do you synchronize your watches and just veer into oncoming traffic?
So what they did was pretty genius. Unlike Hitler in Austria, they actually spent...
That's always a good way to start a plan.
Right. Unlike Hitler in Austria, I prefer macaroni and cheese with hamburger.
I prefer Edelweiss.
What they did was they spent months and months actually putting up new signage and then covering it with black plastic. You know, you see that now when they put a new stoplight in and it's all kind of there and it's not on yet. And you kind of get used to the idea like, oh, there's a thing here now. Yeah.
It's like, ooh, new ride at Disneyland. What's going to happen?
But everybody knew what was happening. And that one of the catchphrases was like, we're not trying to get 99% of the population to know that this is happening. We're trying to get 100% of the population, like zero
that's a good
entropy
goal.
Here.
It's right? a good goal. Because imagine if 1 in 100 Svensons is still, just driving into oncoming traffic.
Just had a team, like running a team of camels and fast asleep at the wheel. So all the signage was there. And in the it was a thing where, you know, a huge army of civil servants and volunteers were all kind of waiting to switch the signs around and take some down and put others up. But in fact, the fulcrum moment was at 4:50 in the morning, on the morning of September 3rd, all traffic in Sweden was to stop. And some places, the transition was happening over a longer period where, non-essential traffic was banned from the road for a whole day. And it was only, key essential drivers that were on the road.
Like but, Seattle for a few months during COVID.
Yeah, wasn't that nice?
Would have been a great
Did
time
you ever
to
go downtown it. During that period?
I actually did.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Tumbleweeds in the streets.
I am legend.
But the cars that were on the road, and in Stockholm, of course, there were a lot of cars that felt like they were necessary cars, probably weren't, just and kind of like when they tore down the viaduct in Seattle, there were a lot of people on the viaduct at 11:59 p.m.
including me.
and it turned into a real scene up there, people spinning donuts and setting off firecrackers.
But that did not happen in community-minded Sweden.
No, at 4:50 everyone stopped.
Whoa. It's like a Twilight Zone. Did they collaborate and listen?
They did. They stopped, collaborated, and listened. And then at 5 a.m., traffic started again, and everybody switched over to the other side of the road. And it went off without a hitch. And it was, it's become a symbol of kind of Swedish efficiency, but also, like a tremendous accomplishment that wouldn't be possible today. And people reflect on this all the time. Like, could we do this now? And it was because there still was a very centralized and conformist idea of like political authority, a kind of a top-down mentality in government that doesn't exist in Sweden now or anywhere.
Well, I mean, you could probably do it in North Korea.
You could do it in North Korea. That's right. But it's easy to think of all of these large infrastructure issues as kind of being fait accomplis or fait accompli. Thank you. We don't have to think about them anymore. But of course, we talk about it a lot here, like the rail gauge switch the rail gauge nonconformity that still exists throughout the world. And looking forward, there are all these situations like you mentioned, self-driving cars that are going to be, that's a system that's going to require a lot of conformity, right? You can't have three different systems working on three different principles.
And it's going to be phased in gradually. So, you're going to have to allow for a lot of different levels of of adoption
and
existing on the roads at the same time.
You've got a bunch of different super large corporations trying to have their system be the one. They're not necessarily collaborating, although I think they learned from the Betamax debacle that really they should at least agree on cheese, right? They should at least agree on some...
Let's have a white paper first.
Some systems. But, here in the United States, I think it's inevitable that internet become a public utility, right? Just like electricity is. But there are a lot of companies that don't want to see that happen, and it requires a lot of coordination, a lot of agreement on the part of people. Where really, 50 years ago, a government could still kind of do that by fiat. And that's maybe less likely to happen now.
In Seattle, people will do what they're told.
We'll have internet as a utility. Mark my words.
We like to march quietly in unison places.
But what's kind of interesting is that Sweden was not the last country to to go through this change. Iceland, although Denmark drove on the right, Iceland was still driving on the left as late as 1968. And the success of Sweden's switcheroo...
That's really interesting.
...inspired Iceland.
Because there's no incentive for them to do so as a sparsely populated and isolated island, except, I guess, the fact that maybe everybody has cars with steering wheels on the left.
And that's the thing. It just sort of depends on where you want to import your cars from. And at sort of joining a global marketplace and realizing that which side of the road you drive on, even as an island nation, kind of changes your relationship to the import-export business, the things that you make, just the way you're oriented. But Iceland decided to make the switch, and in 1968 they did. Now, that was a much smaller...
You just have to call six people.
Yeah, that's right. You're just like...
Bridget, can you stay home?
One guy in a straw hat walks out into the middle of the road with white gloves on and goes, not there, there, go there.
The prime minister is out, like, literally conducting traffic.
But Iceland was not the last country to do it. In 1978, so the residents of Okinawa, over the course of the second half of the 20th century, went from feeling like the United States military was a real boon to the economy.
Thanks for coming in.
To feeling like the United States military was a rapey exploiter. And they were, and continued to be, less and less welcome on Okinawa all the time. You know, the United States still has military bases and a military kind of residency throughout Japan, but the vast majority of U.S. military bases and service people are on Okinawa.
Huge Navy base.
And Okinawa doesn't, or the Okinawans increasingly don't like it. And so over time, the Okinawan independence movement, one of the ways that it expressed itself...
OIM?
...was... and independence, I mean, they are part of Japan, right? But independence from the yoke of American military. In 1978, Okinawa did what is pretty rare, which is switch from right to left. And they rejoined...
The rest of their country.
The rest of their country in switching over to the left-hand side.
And that's not just a symbolic move, because it makes it harder for, you know, cars from the base, right?
To get
on and off local roads.
And so, yeah, now, I mean, the cars, the American cars that are on the base now, all of a sudden, I mean, that was also like a switcheroo. When Hong Kong was reunited with China, China drives on the right, and Hong Kong as a British vassal state was left drive.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the special relationship that Hong Kong has with China, China agreed to retain right-hand drive in Hong Kong.
It would have been a nightmare to try to...
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
But there you have it.
Do you think it's coming? Like, at some point is Beijing going to say, just kidding, or is it just too much of a hassle?
The deal is that until 2047, Hong Kong gets to retain its special status in some ways and not others, right? I don't think you can have a big Falun Gong super party in Hong Kong any more than you can anywhere else in China. But some of the Hong Kong specific rules will still apply until 2047. But most recently, the most recent nation to make this switch is the nation of Samoa, which is a separate country from American Samoa.
Yes.
And Samoa had been driving on the right all this time, partly because of its relationship with Tahiti. But now Samoa, the nation, is sort of administered by New Zealand and has a relationship with...
Oh, right.
...with Australia and New Zealand that's much stronger.
Some of those nations have even been changing their time zone to match the business day in Australia and New Zealand.
Right.
And they want to be in the same time zone.
As New Zealand has become more and more a regional powerhouse, and now, as we know, as futurelings will know, a global military powerhouse, the New Zealand Navy...
I mean, it was the only place that survived... Right. You know, the great disaster.
Right. It's where all the Amazon executives now live in their underground bunkers. But Samoa switched, again, unusually, from right to left in 2009.
Well, I didn't even hear about this.
Right. It.
I guess I can see why I wasn't informed.
Something else was going on in 2009 that day, I guess, that you didn't follow the news. So it's still a possibility.
For us? For the U.S.?
Well,
we switched to the left?
We could switch over. You know, the U.K. actually had a pretty serious debate about it.
How recently?
In the 60s.
Huh.
And it became a political issue. The conservatives were against it. It was right. Part of that, like, Britain first.
Eurozone, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And the progressives, you know, made the case, just as the progressives in the United States in the 70s made the case that we should adopt metric, the metric system.
But it turned out the other side had all the shotguns to shoot at the signs.
That's right. And so it seems now that we are living in a static world. One third of the people drive on the left. But really, it remains anything can happen day.
It works out okay. You know, maybe it's a little parable about respecting each other's differences. A third of us just drive on the left-hand side of the road, something that would be fatal to the rest of us. And yet, it's mostly fine.
I really wonder why.
As long as we stay away from each other. I guess the parable ends there. As long as the different people never interact.
Right. Close the borders.
Right. As long as you have the illusion of heterogeneity in your life or homogeneity in your life.
Yeah. Thinking about it, where would you choose? Oh, you know, Ireland is one I forgot to mention as still being a country that drives on the left in Europe. But again, an island. Where, if you could change which side of the road a country drives on, which country would you choose?
I can choose one country?
You can choose one country in the world. What would you choose?
Wow. I mean, you could really, where could you cause the most trouble? By making the U.S. left-hand drive, I guess?
I think if you made India drive on the right and just change it overnight.
And no tell anybody?
I don't know if anyone would notice.
And that concludes Dagen H, or however you say H in Swedish. Should this be Dagen Osh?
Dagen Osh. I have no idea.
Entry 313.EZ2116, certificate number 30932, in the omnibus. Futurelings, as you may have heard before, we were products of our time and were therefore available on social media at Omnibus Project. I was at Ken Jennings. You can find John usually on Patreon, best place to find him, and his OnlyFans and his Cameo.
That's right. Come on by.
He'll tell you happy birthday or wish you a happy Purim.
Mm-hmm. Happy Purim, everyone.
It doesn't even matter what time of year it is. No matter what message you request, John will wish you happy Purim.
No happier holiday.
You could find us at via electronic mail at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, or through old-timey regular mail, which had not yet been dismantled, at Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. We got some international mail here, although...
Really? International mail?
I lost the box.
That was one of my least favorite catalogs to get when I was a teenager.
M-A-L-E?
I don't know how I got on that mailing list, but... International Mail, they had a lot of sweatpants that had like cod pieces in them.
This was actually just some fetish thing that you didn't know about.
No, it was like in 80s. That was people that wore muscle shirts. International Mail was like a fashion catalog. A lot of pleats. They had a lot of pleats in their pants.
We got a note from Octavia, if that is your real name.
Hello, Octavia.
Who enjoyed the Lego set. Oh, I assumed this was from... Oh, no, it's not. I assume this was actually from, like, Australia, because what it contains is a little off-brand Lego Sydney Opera House.
Oh, isn't that cute? But it's not a Lego.
No, and it also doesn't look anything like the Sydney Opera House. I mean, it's as good as you can get with 22 Lego-like pieces.
That doesn't really... Let me see that.
If I asked you which world landmark that was, you would probably guess the Sydney Opera House, but if I didn't tell you it was the Sydney Opera House...
How... Weird.
It's just kind of a lumpy white thing.
It says compatible, fits all leading brands of...
fits all leading brands.
Snap tight.
When I buy cheap Lego knockoffs at the drugstore, I want to make sure I can go home and put them right on my Lego.
This is weird, this thing. I don't know what to... it feels like if we had a different kind of bunker here, we might display that kind of thing as a like, oh, look at this funny thing. But it's that would be a different kind of bunker.
I'm going to build it. It's only 22 pieces. I'll build it right now. Octavia says that her daughter is very into Lego. She does not want to say Legos. And her daughter uses them to make sea creatures and interdimensional portals.
Oh, nice.
That's a troubling combination.
I wonder if her daughter is only 4, that is really troubling.
I mean, especially if the portals actually work.
Hmm.
Does it just look like a portal, or is she summoning things?
I wonder if her daughter goes to a special school run by a bald man in a wheelchair.
Feel free to send us whatever off-brand CVS Legos you like. Octavia had no qualms about it. You can also find your fellow listeners by looking up Futurelings mm-hmm. on fora like Facebook or Discord or Reddit.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the best way to support the show, there's lots of things you can do. You can tell your friends. You could write a review. You could rate it on your podcast platform of choice.
Oh, we've never suggested this before. Please rate and review.
Unless you don't like the show. Unless you just hate listen to it twice a week.
No, don't
then
do that.
Don't leave your 1-star review like, these guys don't understand cricket.
No, or you could leave a 5-star review and then spend the whole review saying
these guys don't understand cricket.
I love hating this show.
we'll attract that kind of listener. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of Facebook discourse today. As we're recording this, the cricket entry just came out, and there's a lot of people who are just extremely angry about it.
Well, that's an example of a show that you tried to explain cricket to me, so I'm kind of absolved of responsibility because I admitted I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, and I tried to explain it from the point of view of somebody who only understood baseball. And I feel like that paradigm did not strike the cricketers as a very sporting or cricket way to discuss cricket.
I have never met someone who was a fan of cricket that didn't first acknowledge that cricket was impossible to understand. Like they can't, no fan of cricket can feel like, oh, cricket.
It's just garden variety Facebook pedantry where people are like, ugh, I can't believe they butchered this cricket show. And then someone asks, oh, what did they get wrong? And there's really not a lot of...
Yeah.
I feel like it would be more like, well, I would have explained this more, or...
Yeah.
They said this was true, and that is, but they didn't say unless.
Yeah, that was my... I loved all the commentary we got on my episode about canning, where there were a lot of comments that were like, this is terrible, this is dangerous, And I said, in what way? And then the commenters were like, well, I mean, you got everything right, but you didn't mention the one thing that I got my PhD
in. That I'm interested in.
It's like, oh.
Oh, this is good. The laws. Somebody emailed me today to say, oh, my brother loves cricket, and he said the show's pretty good. But I love cricket, and it made me want to gouge my ear off.
Oh, sure.
And I'm not even sure about the grammar or the anatomy of that sentence.
It made me want to gouge my ear off. Well, it's not elegant.
I'm not going to gouge it, and I'm not going to cut it off. I'm going to gouge it off. Sounds painful.
No, it sounds kind of hot. I mean, if you're into torture porn, it feels a little bit like Reservoir Dogs.
Although I am kind of digging into this now. Somebody just said that it's illegal in cricket to bend your elbow more than 15 degrees when you're bowling.
Really?
Is it the only sport where the umpires have a protractor? Anyway, if you're interested in cricket discourse, the Futurelings Facebook page is the place for you. But in addition to writing reviews, which is available to all budgets,
please write and review.
You could support the show by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and looking at the array of perks available to our supporters and deciding which fits your lifestyle.
Lifestyle perks. That's what we're here for.
Yeah, we're Goop, basically.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, where we are still archaically driving on the right side of the road instead of hovering above traffic in a state of blissful sort of multidimensionalism. We have no idea how long our bilateral civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.